Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born in 1923 in Berlin, but escaped from Hitler's Germany with her parents and brother in 1933 when she was just 9 years old. Her father was a drama critic and a distinguished writer whose books were burned by the Nazis. The family passed through Switzerland and France before arriving finally in England in 1936. She's worked as an artist, a television scriptwriter, and for the past 30 years as an author and illustrator of children's books. Her three autobiographical novels are based on her early wandering years. The stories have been internationally acclaimed and have done particularly well in Germany, where they're sometimes used as an easy introduction to difficult periods of German history. She is Judith Carr. Judith, I'd like to start by telling you that you are probably the most influential author in my life. As a small child, I was given When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, and it was the first book that I think I'd ever read to myself as a sentient being. It made me understand what reading was for, what stories were for, and it made me a lifelong reader, so thank you.
Well, I'm amazed, and thank you very much. I had no idea I was going to do anything like that. Thank you.
It is part of a trilogy out of Hitler's Berlin, which are novels. You're very clear to point that out, that they're novels, they're not your autobiography. However, your book that has come out fairly recently, Your Creatures, A Celebration of Your Life and Work, really is a kind of autobiography, isn't it?
That is all factual. Everything in there is factual. Of course, Pink Rabbit was also very factual. I wrote it in the third person rather than the first person, so that I could play with the facts and combine things, perhaps two things which happen separately, make them happen closer together, to leave things out because either they weren't relevant or they simply spoiled the run of the thing. But I don't think I've invented anything that didn't happen. It was as truthful as I could make it about what happened and what the various people were like.
Perhaps you could tell us what did happen. So the protagonist in When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit is called Anna, but of course we're really talking about you. Tell us about the young Judith and what happened just before the outbreak of war.
It started in 1933 for us, which was early. Hitler actually came to power, I think, on the 3rd of March, 1933. I'd lived in Berlin all my life. I was 9 years old, and I had no idea of what was happening around me, even though the Nazis had published a list of people. They said they would stand against the wall and shoot when they came to power, if they came to power. And my father was, I think, number two on that list. But my parents, needless to say, didn't tell me. And I was totally unaware of what was happening in Berlin, even though even then people were beaten up in the streets by Nazis and the police did nothing. People were killed. My father used to write every week and very often warned against Hitler, and he was very funny. People used to read him because he was so entertaining. He normally wrote about drama, but he wrote about this because he could see it coming and a lot of people didn't. And so he was loathed by the Nazis. In the end, I think this was a few weeks before Hitler came to power, he was rung up by someone in the police who'd warned him and said, get out of the country immediately because they're trying to take away your passport, which was possible even before Hitler had come to power. And so that was the first I knew about any of it, because he simply disappeared. He was there one evening, sick in bed with flu, and next morning he was gone. I didn't know what had happened. I was terrified. And my mother then had to explain to us that he had taken the next train out of Germany and why. But it had been so quick, it had all happened so quickly, that my parents hadn't really had time to talk about what to do next. And my mother didn't dare telephone him. He'd gone to Prague, which was the quickest way out of the country, because they were listening to phone calls. So she took a train to Prague herself and just spent a few hours with my father and asked him, you know, what do we do now? And he said wisely, as it turned out, that he wanted my mother and my brother and me out of Germany before the elections, which in fact brought Hitler to power. And so she did that. She came back, and it must have been very difficult because she had to sort of, I think she only had about 10 days in which to do it. And then all during this time, Michael, my brother, and I weren't allowed to tell anyone that my father had gone or that we were about to leave ourselves, which was quite difficult because people, my father was so well known that people kept asking us about him and why isn't he writing anything? We said, well, he still got flu. And, you know, it was a very long flu to go on with. So we went to Stuttgart and spent the night there. And then next morning we took a sort of milk train at 5 o'clock in the morning because, you know, obviously they weren't going to watch that. And we got to Zurich where my father was waiting for us.
And that began a peripatetic childhood. You were in Zurich, you were then in France, you were eventually in England, and all of this time learning new languages, going to new schools, until you spent some time with your grandparents and then finally joined your parents in England. And of course, by then it was the war.
Well, it wasn't quite the war. It was March 36. I mean, both Michael and I sort of wondered, I wonder what it would be like here. You know, we'd gone to school in Switzerland and then in Paris and in Nice. It was fascinating. And by this time, we spoke perfect French. And so the thought of learning English wasn't that daunting, just slightly annoying. Well, we'd just done that and now we've got to do another one. But it was very easy, in fact.
Of course, one constant that stayed with you throughout it was your talent for drawing, and you learned very early on, as you explain in the book, the difference between drawing and illustration.
Yes, well, I was four and a half, at my German kindergarten, and it's been fine up till then, you know. I'd done all the things like making a salt cellar out of cardboard and things that you have to do at kindergarten. But then the Fräulein suddenly produced a flower and dumped it down in the middle of the table and said, today we are all going to draw a tulip. So I looked at this thing and it seemed to be made up of little sort of rounded shapes, petals in fact, but I didn't know they were called petals. And so I drew one, and then the thing is, you don't keep still as a child, so the next time I looked at them from a slightly different direction. The petal was no longer the same shape as it had been. It was very confusing, and I kept trying to draw these petals, and each time they moved, and I was getting a bit fed up. And then suddenly the Fräulein came and looked at what I was doing and was horrified and said, what on earth are you doing? Don't you know how we draw a tulip? And she drew one for me, which was just one outline, sort of curved at the bottom, and three little zigzags at the top, and a stalk. And I was amazed because quite clearly she had drawn a tulip. Anybody could see that this was a tulip. And I'd been struggling with all these funny shapes and things. So I thought, well, this is obviously a better way of doing things. And I'm not going to do this business of looking at things again, even though it had looked quite different.
Of course, drawing continued on in your life. You went to school in England and finally you gained a scholarship to art school.
Yes, well, it was very difficult to get a scholarship because they were nearly all for British born only. And I'd been going to evening classes and had a very nice and very good tutor called John Farley, who was a painter and illustrator. And he tried very hard to find a scholarship that they would give me. And he found something called a trade scholarship, which meant that you worked in a trade associated with drawing for 2 days a week, and they then paid you enough money that you could go to art school the remaining 3 days of the week. So I went to see the man who controlled these things with my portfolio. He went through it all, and then he said, well, yes, this is all very nice, but I'm awfully sorry. I'm afraid this scholarship is only for British-born also. So I was aghast, and then he said, let's see what we can do about this. And he just bent the rules and gave me the scholarship, which was terribly marvellous. I wish I could remember his name. He'll be long dead by now, but I always remember him. If I had prayers, I would remember him in my prayers.
I want to go forward now to when television came into your life, because it was a revelation.
Yes, that was purely chance and a wonderful, wonderful piece of luck. I'd finished art school by then, and I was trying to be a painter. I was teaching 2 days a week to earn enough money to live on. And it happened to be across the road from the television studios. It's difficult to imagine now, but very few people had actually seen television at that point. This was 52, and it was all mysterious and very interesting. And then I happened to meet at a friend's house a woman who actually worked in television. She was a secretary at the studios across the road. And she said, why don't you come and have lunch with me one day? So I did that, and we went into the canteen, which was packed as usual, and it so happened that my future husband, Nigel Neal, always known as Tom, sat down at the table. I can't remember what we talked about, but I know he walked me back to the bus stop, and I gave him my telephone number. And he rang up a few days later, and we went out. We went out to see a play. It was unbelievably bad. It was so bad. It was terribly funny. There was a bit when they did one of these dances, I forget what they're called. Two people stand opposite each other and try to hit each other's hands. And of course, they hadn't rehearsed enough, and they kept missing each other. And all this symbolism going on at the same time. And Tom and I were just in stitches. We were practically on the floor. And then we went out and we had a Chinese meal. And that was really it. We both knew we wouldn't say anything. But I remember looking at him on the tube and thinking, I'm sure this is the man I'm going to marry, and sort of looking at him to see what he looked like. And he did the same. He told me.
So you got married. You both worked in television for a time. You were reading first and then writing scripts. And in due course, you had children. And this, of course, is what gave rise to your fabulous series of children's books. I'm thinking here mostly now of The Tiger That Came to Tea, which was the first children's book that you wrote.
Yes, it's slightly annoying because it's still the most successful. And I do think I've done an awful lot of work since then to try and get better. But I think the reason it worked was because it's something I made up for my daughter, a bedtime story, when she was 2 going on 3. It was one she liked and so demanded to hear it again and again. And I suppose gradually edited it in the sense that, you know, when I saw her sort of looking out of the window and scratching herself, I knew that was a dull bit and probably cut it out. And I put in quite deliberately, as you do, all the things that she liked, like She's fascinated by going out in the dark, for instance. So I had them going out in the dark. And we'd seen the tigers at the zoo. We both thought they were the most beautiful thing you could imagine. You know, those colors and the stripes and the way they look and the way they move. And I think it was a time when Tom was writing. He was writing a film script with Laurence Olivier, actually, the entertainer, and he was out a lot with the director. They were filming and stuff. And we were a bit sort of fed up because it was lonely at home, because he normally worked at home, and we were sort of wishing that something would happen, that someone should come and just be there with us. So it seemed quite reasonable to make a story up about a tiger coming. And then I told it to Matthew, our son, who was born about that time, not long after, and he liked it too. Though I think, actually, he was very good at making up stories himself, so he may have been more critical, I think. He became a prize-winning writer, so he started early.
You always had domestic cats too, slightly smaller than tigers, and the first of which was, or the one that became famous, was of course Mog.
Yes. Well, I'd always longed for a cat because I thought they looked so wonderful, and of course couldn't have one because we were moving about all the time. Tom loved cats and always had cats, so as soon as we got a house, this house actually, with a garden, we got this cat, which we called Mog, and I was totally fascinated by the things she did. I mean, it's totally different from dogs or anything like that. They do these extraordinary, weird things. It's all about power, really, that they make you do things somehow. So, having published The Tiger, I thought I would try and do a book just about all the things this cat did. The only thing was that it couldn't just be a list of things that the cat did. There had to be a plot. And I said something about that to Tom, who was very busy with script and more important things, and just said, oh, let her catch a burglar. So that's what I did.
But there are how many Mog books now?
I think there are 17, but 4 of them are little tiny baby books, so they're not really very strong. And they're not all based on Mog, because we got lots more cats because the children wanted a kitten each, and then they had kittens. So there were a whole lot. I'm on my 9th cat now. And they were all mad, because all cats are. And they all did these extraordinary, weird things. We had this one that was horrified by Christmas. And so I thought, I'd been doing other things, but I thought, this is really too good to miss. And I was going to write a book about another cat that was horrified by Christmas. But then I thought, well, you know, there's going to have to be another family. It's ridiculous. I'll just stick it on Mog. So all the things that these various mad cats did, I stuck on Mog with the same family.
Now, since then, you've written about foxes, you've written about angels, you've written about geese. I say written, these are illustrated books. Of course, you've also at the same time been doing your unillustrated writing, the whole Hitler series. One book that you gave up, you said this particular book had no wish to be written by me. But your most recent book, which is just about to come out in paperback, is called Mr. Cleghorn's Seal.
Yes, now this is something I had always wanted to do. I had always wanted to do a book that came between picture books and full-length novels, because I noticed a great dearth of these when my children were about 8. And also I wanted very much to do all those pencil drawings, all these black and white drawings mixed with the text, and something not nearly as long as a full-length novel, but definitely proper reading. I can't remember ridiculously though it is, since it's only quite a short time ago, I can't remember when I got the idea of doing this story about the seal, because I'd always known that my father, as a very young man, had kept for a while a seal on his balcony, which he'd rescued. It was a seal pup whose mother had been accidentally shot. So he was in Brittany, I think it was, or Normandy at the time. And the man who, the fisherman, he was going out with a fisherman in the boat, and this is when it happened. The fisherman was culling seals because they were taking all his fish, but just culling them very carefully, not too many, and accidentally he found he'd shot a female seal who had a pup, and he said, this is awful, but I have to shoot the pup as well because it'll just starve very slowly and it's very cruel to leave them. And my father, who loved animals and was a fairly impulsive person, said, oh no, don't do that, I'll have it, I'll take it. And so they put the seal into some kind of a box with some seaweed, I think, and he took it on the train. He had to go in the luggage van to Berlin, which was a long way, and I think they even had to change trains. But my father kept visiting it in the luggage van, and he must have got some water. He trickled water over it, and he tried to feed it a mixture of milk and some kind of fish oil, I think. And not very successfully, because the seal was very young. But when they got to Berlin, late at night, he'd used up all his milk, and he knew he hadn't got any at home, he'd been away. So he and the seal took a taxi to a restaurant where he ordered some milk for the seal. And I don't know, I can't visualize the scene, whether they were sitting at a table or what happened. Anyway, it was totally successful. And he then went home with another taxi to his flat, and he put the seal first in his bath, I think, to give it a good watering, and then he put it on his balcony. But the thing was that by this time, the seal, which was only very young, had become attached to my father, and it didn't want to be left on the balcony. And when he tried to go back into the room, it came after him, sort of humpeting along and going, oomph, oomph, what they do. So my father, of course, was terribly touched by this. Well, he had to leave it on the balcony, I suppose, and go to bed, but I think he sort of watered it a bit. He tried to feed it. This was the thing, he couldn't really feed it. The seal was too young. It was still only suckling, and my father tried everything, I think, bottles, and I think he totally drenched an old jacket in his mixture of fish oil and milk, and the seal managed to suck a bit out of that, but not enough. And so then he tried to give it to the zoo, and for some reason they couldn't have it. The aquarium couldn't have it either. So in the end, there was nothing to do but to have it put down because it was getting so sad and thin. Then, of course, being a Victorian, he had it stuffed. Well, this was quite normal in those days. You know, photography was something extremely complicated. You had to go and see a person who would do it. You couldn't do a selfie of yourself with your seal. And so people did it quite often to remember a much-loved pet. And I remember this seal when I was little. It was my father's study on the floor, and I used to sit on it and stroke it.
Mr. Cleghorn's seal has a happier outcome. In your book, Creatures, you say, my Manx husband always referred to his parents as his creatures, so this title includes not only much-loved animals, but also a much-loved family. And there's such a moving dedication at the back of the book, and I wondered if I could ask you just to read what you wrote here.
This book is dedicated to the 1.5 million Jewish children who didn't have my luck and all the pictures they might have painted.
Well, Judith, before we go, I'd like to tell you another reason why your book, When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit, is so precious to me, because it's about some of those children who didn't make it. The book, as you see here, this is my own copy, is dedicated to my much older sister for her 21st birthday. This is a copy that she owned and loved and then handed down to me. She was killed in the 1970s in the Rhodesian Civil War. And then much later, after the death of my father, my mother could finally tell me that they'd given me this book in order to prepare me for the secret that I didn't know, which was that my father had been born in Poland and at 15 had come to Britain and had never seen his family, his sister, his mother, his father ever again. So those Jewish children, I feel, that you've written my story and theirs.
I've always been conscious of having been terribly lucky not to have had that fate. But I think a thing I particularly remember was we were in Prague once, Tom and I, on holiday, and the Nazis in Prague had left a Jewish cemetery untouched. It was very small and terribly crowded. The stones were very close together. And I think it was to show, you know, how rotten these Jews really were. They only had a rotten little cemetery like that. And below it was what I think may have been a sort of secret synagogue, which they had dug, which was still there. And we went down some steps into this hole. And there was an exhibition of drawings done by Jewish children in, must have been Theresienstadt, because they wouldn't be able to draw anywhere else. And they were just two kinds. They were the kind of drawings that all children do of mummy and daddy in the dining room with the table and the chairs and the dog, all of which had gone from their lives. And then others, perhaps slightly older ones, who drew what they saw around them, such as bodies hanging, dead people, people being beaten. It was totally staggering. And I thought, well, you know, I knew how lucky I was, but, you know, they were my friends. I'm so conscious of what these people would have given just to have our lives.
What do you plan to do with the rest of yours?
Well, I'm not quite sure how much of it there's going to be. I just keep drawing, really. That's what I like doing, and something I can do, and writing bits, but mainly drawing. I've always wanted to draw.
Such an honour to meet you, Judith. Thank you. Judith Carr's Creatures, a celebration of the life and work of Judith Carr, is published by HarperCollins. All of her previous children's books still in print. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to producer Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or our app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.